Today we're examining the civil war and humanitarian crisis in the Darfur region of Sudan, where more than a million people have been driven from their villages and tens of thousands have been killed. To explain the roots of the conflict, we turn to John Prendergast. He's followed events in Sudan for 20 years, and he's been involved with other humanitarian emergencies and civil wars in Africa. He was a member of the National Security Council in the Clinton administration, and he's currently a special advisor to the International Crisis Group. Prendergast was in the Darfur region of Sudan last month. I asked him to explain the origins of the conflict.
Well, as always, these wars are very, very complicated, and I think there are a few very elementary reasons why we're seeing a major war and then an ethnic cleansing that's resulted from it. There are environmental factors. Certainly in this part of the world, the Sahara Desert is encroaching. It's moving further and further south. This is disrupting the traditional land tenure patterns of both the agriculturalists and particularly the pastoral groups in Darfur. There are socioeconomic factors involved, of course, as certain groups are disadvantaged by this environmental change and disadvantaged by the economic changes that result from the environmental shifts. And then there are political reasons for the conflict, as certain groups perceive themselves to be marginalized and cut out of the political processes that govern the country. So all of these have led to a rebellion by what are primarily three ethnic groups that are African groups, they're not Arab groups, from Darfur. And these three groups have formed two different rebel movements, which have begun fighting in early 2003. And by April 2003, by April or May 2003, the government had responded by using these militia called Janjaweed as its principal means, its first line of defense. And by arming these Janjaweed and thus siding with one of the groups in the intense competition for resources and giving that group impunity and arming it and encouraging it to wipe out the civilian population of the rebels, we saw this extraordinary campaign of ethnic cleansing unfold.
Now, what is the Janjaweed's interest in attacking these African tribes?
Yeah, the Janjaweed have their roots in a racist ideology. They're a very small subsection in their origin of the larger Arab groups in Darfur. They're sort of a Ku Klux Klan version of the narrow opinion in Darfur that believes that the Arabs are the rightful owners of the land and should therefore drive African populations out of the area. So by siding with this narrow band of people, the government basically threw gasoline on a small fire. These Janjaweed were given impunity, were given freedom to do whatever they wanted to do, and they effectively burned down half of the villages in Darfur and displaced half of the people in Darfur and killed a very high percentage of them. So it's a remarkable war strategy on the part of the government. It was very effective, as a matter of fact, because it actually inhibits the rebels' ability to move around now because they don't have civilian support base anymore. But the impact on humanitarian terms and human rights terms is profound and really unmatched since we've seen since 1994's genocide in Rwanda.
Now, the Sudanese government has said, among other things, that the people in Darfur are victims of an old ethnic and tribal conflict that has really little to do with the central government. What concrete evidence is there that the Sudanese government is complicit in this campaign of massacres and ethnic cleansing?
Well, first of all, the government wants people to see this as a local conflict. They want to see it as a so-called tribal conflict. It's the strategy of the government throughout the country, because Darfur is not the only place, by the way, in Sudan that is on fire or has been on fire over the last 10 years. And so the government has tried to, rather than have people perceive the conflict as it rightly is, which is groups of people around the country which feel cut out of the political and economic processes in the country and who are rebelling against that government. They want them to see local conflicts where tribes are battling tribes and it's chaos and anarchy and they can do very little about it. And by taking sides with one group over another in an underlying economic conflict over resources, the government very wisely created additional tensions and hatreds now that will take generations to unfold and unravel. So they've been quite effective at what they're doing. In terms of their ability to, or their relationship with the Janjaweed, the evidence is accumulating. The Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International reports, as well as the reports by the group that I work for, the International Crisis Group, all have begun to document the very specific ties between the government in Khartoum and specific Janjaweed leaders who have received major arms shipments and then distributed those arms with specific instructions, have used government barracks, and most damning and most obvious in terms of evidence, have been backed in most of their attacks by government attack helicopters and government ground troops, and even high-altitude bombing by the Antonovs that the government uses. So it's been very coordinated. The government has supported these Janjaweed militias to attack, and it's backed them up just in case they run into any rebels. If it was just the Janjaweed attacking, it in fact may have been handled to some degree by the rebel forces. But because it was such a mismatch with both Janjaweed and government attacking, the rebels were simply overrun in many places, and the civilian populations were devastated as a result.
What tactics did the Janjaweed and the Sudanese government use in attacking these villages? What exactly were they trying to do?
Well, in talking to refugees and in talking to internally displaced Sudanese all over the country, they come back with the same story, which begins early in the morning with an attack by a high-altitude government plane, which drops a payload of bombs on a particular village. And that, of course, that will kill some people, but usually that's designed just to destabilize people. So they come running out of their huts and houses and rushing around in uncertainty about what's happened. Just as they're rushing out of their huts, the Janjaweed militia come in either on camels or on horseback, usually on camels, and start shooting and attacking civilians. Sometimes the raping starts right away. Sometimes they wait until the women have been collected in certain areas. But they're usually trying to kill the men and boys. And then if that's not enough, if that's not effective, or if lots of people are escaping, then we see the reports, the consistent reports of a government attack helicopter then being the third line, in effect, after the high-altitude bombing and then the Janjaweed attack. Then the helicopter moves in and starts shooting people that are running away firing missiles and exploding many of the structures remaining in the village. And this is usually overseen by government ground troops, which are off in the distance, who are watching the scenario unfold and are on standby just in case there's a rebel detachment there. So that's the pattern. It happens almost every time. At the end of that, usually the government will move in and along with the Janjaweed and start a cleanup operation, in quotes, which involves having the bodies of the victims of the killing stuffed into the wells to make the water supply poison and thus the village uninhabitable for some time to come. So that's been the pattern that is documented over and over again by survivors of these attacks.
What do the Janjaweed hope to accomplish with this kind of brutality? I mean, are they in effect hoping to steal this land for their own herding activities in the future?
Yeah, I think that is precisely what is implied in the government's promise and the government's provision of impunity to them. They don't, of course, without being prosecuted for all these crimes and driving the non-Arab groups out of their villages, they now have access to that land. They don't want to live in these villages. They just want access to the pasture land. And because, again, and we go back to the earlier discussion about the encroachment of the Sahara Desert as it moves southward and reduces their space for watering their animals. They just want the freedom to roam into these areas, and it's becoming increasingly restricted. So I think this is a major advance for them and their economic agenda to be able to have a free rein now in terms of their grazing and pasture land for their animals. And not only that, and perhaps even more importantly, I mean, they've stolen tens of thousands of head of cattle representing in dollar terms literally hundreds of millions of dollars of wealth. These were wealthy areas in Darfur, particularly in North Darfur. People had accumulated huge herds of livestock, particularly camels and in the southern part of Darfur, cattle. And these are tremendous savings accounts, in effect, for the communities. And all of them have been transferred now to the Arab groups that are involved with the Janjaweed. So these guys are major criminal networkers now, and they not only undertake their attacks there, but they also cross border into Chad to undertake cattle raiding and camel raiding there as well. And they sell their goods up into Libya and into the Gulf. So they've internationalized their criminal activity, and this is all with the full support of the government of Sudan.
John Prendergast. He's a former member of the National Security Council and a special advisor to the International Crisis Group. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. Let's continue our conversation with John Prendergast about the conflict and humanitarian crisis in the Darfur region of Sudan. Prendergast is a former member of the National Security Council and a special advisor to the International Crisis Group. When a government is accused of the kind of brutality and human rights violations that this one is, we often see behind it a particular strongman, if you will. We know little about the Sudanese government. Where did they come from? What kind of government is it?
Well, over the last 40 years, a small but growing movement, what they call Islamist movement, which would be a political Islam organization, formed and grew and penetrated the structures of the state in Sudan, the post-colonial state in Sudan. And finally, by 1989, they were ready to make their move to take power. They certainly couldn't in an election, because the only democratic election that had been held during the 1980s was one in which they only secured about 12% of the vote. So they had a very small base, but they engineered a coup in 1989 that took power and immediately began to introduce their vision of an Islamic state. And they destroyed all forms of opposition, drove the political parties out of the country and underground, crushed the unions, and they've basically been on a roll ever since then.
So is this a military regime? Are they isolated? Do they have international support?
Yeah, it's a military regime that has assiduously developed alliances within the Arab League over the years. It has allies in parts of Africa and it's been able to buy new allies as a result of its oil diplomacy. In other words, providing concessional rates to countries that it wants to be sympathetic towards it for whatever political purposes it has, can provide, because it's now a major oil exporter, can provide that energy at reduced rates. So it has some tools at its disposal to build friendships abroad. And those friendships have come in handy at times when the international pressure gets too hot, as it is now. And you have countries all over the world running interference for Khartoum on the Security Council and in other forums that lead other governments who are more concerned about human rights and humanitarian assistance very perplexed as to how to ultimately influence the government and the larger international community to try to take, again, more assertive action in response to the crisis there in Darfur.
Is the Taliban sort of a rough model for this kind of regime, or are they similar?
I think this regime in Khartoum is much more pragmatic. These guys have a desire to play ball in the international institutions, even while they're perpetrating actions at home that ought to get them thrown out of these institutions. And so I think that they're very, very different than the Taliban in their worldview. They're all educated in Europe and North America, and they desire to be accepted, and not only accepted, to be players, to act as a bridge between Africa and the Middle East, to be major actors in the Islamic world. So I think that they have these kinds of desires, which makes them somewhat permeable to pressure. And that's why there is some hope that you could actually influence this government, whereas in Afghanistan, perhaps the Taliban was beyond influence.
Has this campaign of the Janjaweed and the government been effective in defeating or discouraging the rebel groups?
I think that the Janjaweed strategy, the government's use of the Janjaweed in attacking the support base of the civilians has been dramatically successful. It has definitely eroded the rebels' ability to conduct military operations against the government. It's reduced the mobility of the rebels significantly, and it's made their opportunities for undertaking military actions against the government has just reduced those considerably. So yes, it's been a very effective strategy. The problem is that as effective as it's been in pure military terms, it will have backfired when all is said and done, because so many people, young people particularly, have lost so many family members that they feel the only future that they have is to join a rebel group, one of the two rebel groups, and fight against this government for as long as they can. Can't bring back their relatives, but certainly can exact some justice in their view. And so we interviewed many, many child soldiers as we were traveling throughout the throughout Darfur, and we just kept asking them, rebel soldiers, why did you join? Young kids, why did you join the rebels? And they said, because my father was killed, because my brother was killed, because my mother was raped. I had no choice. So the government, I think, overplayed its hand, successfully defeated or at least undermined the rebel support base, but has now driven thousands of young people into the arms of the rebels, which will create a hostile force to it for the coming years. It will make it much more difficult for this war to be resolved.
Our guest is John Prendergast. He's currently a special advisor to the International Crisis Group and recently visited the Darfur region of Sudan. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is John Prendergast. He was a member of the National Security Council in the Clinton administration. He's currently a special advisor to the International Crisis Group and recently visited the Darfur region of Sudan. Well, John Prendergast, tell us what you saw when you were in Darfur this summer.
Well, we had a chance to talk to, most importantly, we had a chance to talk to refugees and people inside Darfur who've been displaced. Went with Samantha Power, the Harvard professor, and we went and traveled around the rebel-held zones of Darfur rather than the government-held areas, which if you go through that, you're often just on some kind of stage-managed tour. So we wanted to get a better sense from the people who had been victimized what really happened. So we got a chance to talk to people and really find out, you know, the extent to which they had suffered at the hands of these Janjaweed and government attacks. We also went to burned villages. We saw village after village that had been destroyed. We walked through those villages and we saw the remains of the lives the people had led before these brutal attacks, you know, decades and decades of evidence of their savings, you know, the huge grain stores that had been burned and all of the various personal items that people had accumulated were all left as people just rushed out of their houses to try to save themselves. And then we saw, quite disturbingly, a mass grave site in which young men had been brought up to a ravine and asked to lay down, obviously, in the ravine and then shot in the back of the head, lined up side by side. So we came back to Chad, of course, to talk more to the refugees who were there in the Chadian camps, and they just continue to validate the story after story of people who have been suffering in the hands of this government. And none of them want to go back unless there's an international force there to protect them. They won't go back as a result of the Sudan government providing more police. They won't go back based on government promises that they won't do anything or anymore to these villages. They will only go back if there are international guarantees in the form of troops that will protect people from the marauding militias and the government forces that have displaced them in the first place.
How has the United States' involvement with Iraq and Sudan's ties to other Arab regimes affected the situation?
Well, I think in the Security Council, in the United Nations Security Council, for example, the United States is unwilling to utilize some of the leverage it has to try to get other countries to go along with our agenda, which would be an agenda that would be more forceful in its pressure on the government of Sudan. it's unwilling to exercise that leverage because we want to save that leverage for Iraq. They're not going to tell you that, but that's a clear dynamic, and everyone realizes it in New York. And then on the ground, we have a great deal of trouble convincing governments throughout the Middle East that, in fact, there is a crisis in Darfur. Remember, this is the same administration here in Washington that brought you Secretary Powell with his dramatic speech and presentation of all the intelligence on Iraq in advance of the vote that allowed the use of force. So I think people are very skeptical, especially in the Middle East, very skeptical of what the United States says about these kinds of things. And the Sudan government has assiduously courted Arab opinion in the most dramatic terms, saying the United States simply wants to invade our country. They want to do the same thing they did to Iraq. Help us. Don't let them do this. And a number of countries have responded to this. So it's become a very, very difficult global environment for more assertive action in Darfur right now.
A lot of Americans remember that during the 90s, Al-Qaeda had operations in Sudan. Does the Sudanese government still have ties to Islamic militant groups? And how does that affect this?
It's a very murky picture. The Sudan government, in response to the sanctions that were placed on it by the Clinton administration and by the Security Council during the 90s, slowly disengaged. They threw bin Laden out. They asked many of the other groups that were housed in Sudan to leave. Over time, this cooperation with the United States escalated in the aftermath of September 11 attacks, because the government in Khartoum was worried that they might be the next target after Afghanistan. And so I think that at this point, the ties remain minimal to major groups that are threatening Western interests. However, there are reports all the time of the use of the territory of Sudan for both training and transit by not only Al-Qaeda elements, but other groups as well, particularly Palestinian groups. And so I think that it remains an issue of concern, perhaps even grave concern, to those working on the counterterrorism efforts here in Washington as well as other parts of the world. But it is not the problem that it posed in the early to mid-1990s before it was pressured into changing its behavior.
The UN Security Council has finally taken some action on the situation in Sudan. What exactly have they done, and how effective will it be?
Well, the Security Council passed a resolution at the very end of July, which, by the way, was the first resolution that they passed on this situation in Darfur, despite the fact that the ethnic cleansing had been ongoing for 16 months. It was very late, and it was a very weak response. It effectively said that it warned the government. It said there may be some consequences if you don't improve the humanitarian situation, if you don't protect civilians, if you don't start peace talks. But it didn't specify what those actions would be. So we got a very, very weak resolution, which the only operative phrase was to impose sanctions on arms sanctions on non-governmental organizations in Sudan. That means the rebels, who were the only groups that can, in fact, protect civilians, are now subject to an arms embargo, but the government is not. So at this point, they have a 30-day deadline, the government does, to respond to some of the requests that the Security Council has made with respect to civilian security and humanitarian assistance. And unfortunately, though, the next week, the United Nations Security Secretary General Kofi Annan sent his new special envoy, a Dutch diplomat named Jan Pronk. He sent him there, and Pronk negotiated an agreement with the government that gave them another 30 days. And he basically said, well, we don't really think that the government can succeed in implementing all the things that the Security Council wants it to do in this short of time period. It's unrealistic to think it could. So it just took the wind out of the sails of the Security Council action. The UN undercut itself, and I think the Sudan government is laughing as it continues to wage a terror campaign in Darfur.
In your view, what would it take to ensure the safety of these villagers and reverse this human suffering? I mean, are we talking about American troops?
I don't think the Americans need to be involved. I think that that at this point, the African forces that have volunteered to deploy to the refugee camps and the internally displaced camps throughout Darfur and Chad would be a sufficient deterrent to further attacks by both the Janjaweed militias and the government forces. The Rwandans and the Nigerians and Tanzanians and others who have promised that they would be that they could send forces, I think would be more than enough to protect civilians and give them the confidence that over time they could return to their villages and try to rebuild their lives. I think the United States presence, it would be a very disruptive one, that it would draw elements from Iraq down to Sudan for soft targets, and we would be in a situation which would just divert attention from the fundamentally important imperative now of just protecting people and protecting their livelihoods and their return to their homes. And I think that the African troops that are volunteering for this job can do the job. And I don't think they need to have necessarily a major deployment of Western forces to be involved in that, although what they will need is provisions, logistics, equipment, and all the kind of things that will allow them to do their job well. And that the United States has to lead on. We have to be the, I think, first and foremost provider of that kind of assistance to allow those troops to do their job.
And as somebody who's watched Sudan for, I guess, almost 20 years, I'm kind of wondering at what frustration you feel at seeing this gathering crisis.
Well, if the leaders of the international community wouldn't make such beautiful speeches, I think I would be less frustrated. But every single one of the leaders of the countries on the Security Council, in the European Union, and particularly here in the United States, have made very, very dramatic speeches about the importance of never again in the context of Rwanda and its 10th anniversary, and in the context of even in Sudan and preventing the destruction from continuing. But they're not willing to undertake the kind of action to back up these pledges. And I think that is a tremendously frustrating thing for all of us who are trying to respond to this. But it's got to be just heartbreaking and soul-breaking for the people of Darfur as they hear on their radios, as they're huddled in these refugee camps and these displaced camps, all these wonderful speeches that are made. Even visitors that come, the Secretary General of the United Nations, the Secretary of State of the U.S., who came to Darfur and said, we won't let this continue, and then they just don't do anything about it. So I think that it is even more crushing for them than it is for all the people around the world who are trying to bring attention to what is happening in Darfur. And we have to remember those victims as we wonder what our world leaders are willing to do to stop it.
Well, John Prendergast, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
John Prendergast. He's a special advisor to the International Crisis Group on the crisis in Sudan.